Very nice to see you all here tonight. I had mentioned this morning that I wanted to spend a few Sunday nights, talking about some, I think, significant prophecies in the Bible, particularly in the New Testament. And over the course of, I think, a few weeks, I'd like to talk to you about what the Bible would say about the Antichrist and about the millennium and about Jerusalem, what's going on in the Middle East, and about the return of Christ. But I want to take at least a couple of Sunday nights to talk to you out of Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24 are the recorded words of Jesus. And it's really the only extended prophecy that Jesus gave. And when you look at Matthew chapter 24, and then you listen to modern teaching on prophecy, you see that a lot of modern teaching on prophecy is coming out of Matthew chapter 24. For instance, you would hear that Jesus Christ is going to return when the gospel is finally preached to every person. And in fact, I was watching, I read a book, but I heard him say it in person. I was reading a book by Jimmy Swaggart a while back. And why the Snickers? One of the things Jimmy Swaggart believes is that his call that he received very early on in life was to preach the gospel and be the sort of the catalyst to the gospel going to every creature. And so his main ministry has been to buy TV channels and to buy set up towers. And his belief is that, again, when the gospel is preached to the entire world, the end of time would come, and he sees himself as playing a large part in the ushering in of the coming of Christ. That comes out of Matthew 24. That ideal that he would have would come out of Matthew 24. This passage mentions that there'll be famines and earthquakes and wars and rumors of wars and natural disasters before the coming of Christ. And again, when you hear those kinds of things, it's coming out of Matthew chapter 24. Some of the doctrine concerning the Antichrist and his activity that you hear on TV about him being in the temple and sort of desecrating the temple that many believe would be rebuilt at the end of time comes again out of Matthew 24. So it is an important passage. And when you listen to Bible prophecy and when you think about what you yourself believe the Bible to teach about what's ahead, it is a passage that I think is worthy of your consideration. Now, it's in Matthew, and I should say this, Mark and Luke. It's not in John, but Matthew gives it the longest attention. There's a parallel passage, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21 are all parallel passages. But again, Matthew gives the most detail, and for that reason, most people would focus on the Matthew chapter 24 passage. Now, let me read this to you, and you'll notice maybe some things that you've heard in the context of people talking about future events. Matthew chapter 24, verse 1 says, "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, 'Do not you see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down.' And so he sat on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age. And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginnings of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. Now that passage continues for many, many verses, but I want to stop right there, and I think that's really all that we can take on in our time frame. And you'll notice, if you have that passage open before you, that the context is that Jesus and his disciples, and in fact, Mark will say not all of his disciples, but only Peter, James, John, and Andrew are with him. So Jesus, Peter, James, John, Andrew are together, and they're in Jerusalem, and they come to this temple that was awe-inspiring. I mean, it was a marvelous thing to behold. In the temple, there were some single stones that were 67 feet long, 7.5 feet high, and 9 feet wide. That's just one stone. It was a beautiful thing. There was nothing really like the Jewish temple in the entire ancient world. Now, this was the third Jewish temple. The first one had been built by Solomon about 1,000 years before Jesus is speaking here, which is about 30 AD. It had been torn down. It stood for about 400 years before it was torn down by the Babylonians. A guy named Nebuchadnezzar sent the army to tear down the temple. After they came back from Babylonian exile, they built another temple called Zerubbabel's temple about 500 years before Jesus is here. And that temple stood for about 350 years, but it was torn down by the Syrians, who came in and desecrated it and again demolished it. And then about 20 years before Jesus was born, Herod, which is Herod the Great, began to build a third temple for the Jews. And it was still in the process, really, of being built when Jesus was there, because they finished the temple, they say, in 64 A.D., and Jesus is here in 30 A.D., so there's still some finishing touches that were to be put on the temple. But again, the grandeur of it was magnificent, the historians say that the stones there were red and white, alternating, and 9 of the gates that went into the temple were overlaid with silver and gold. And there's a lot of, history in regards to just the absolute splendor of this building. But there is Jesus, and he says, as they're showing him this temple, he says, the day is coming when not one stone will be left upon another. It's going to be tore down. And the question is, did that happen? And the answer is yes. In 70 AD, 40 years after Jesus said that it would be torn down, the Romans came in. There was a general named Titus. Titus would later become one of the Caesars. And Titus and his army went in and destroyed the temple. And the soldiers dug up the very foundation of the temple. It was destroyed, and the only thing that was left was what we know of as the Wailing Wall and three towers. The three towers were left to show people that here once stood a prosperous city that the Romans destroyed. The Wailing Wall was just left there by the Romans as a place of defense for them to put their soldiers in case they were ever attacked. Now the Wailing Wall still stands. By the way, Micah chapter 3 verse 12 prophesies, "There shall Zion for your sake, therefore," let me back up, "therefore shall Zion for your sake be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountain of the house as the high places of the forest." That is again repeated in Jeremiah 26. So the prophecy of the Old Testament was there is coming a day when the temple will be plowed. And here is Jesus saying, yes, it's going to be torn down. There won't be one stone left upon another. Now, the Romans were cruel. And I'll just say this, and I'll say it in various ways as we go. The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in particular, it would be hard for us to comprehend in regards to what it did to the psyche of the Jewish people. F.F. Bruce says that as the siege wore on, because Titus goes in and he surrounds the city of Jerusalem, the Romans surround the city, and basically they don't attack it. They starve it to death. And inside were about 1.2 million Jews. Now, Jerusalem didn't have that many inhabitants. There were only about 200,000 people that lived in Jerusalem. But it was Passover, and the city was packed to the gills with Jewish people. The city itself could only support 200,000. There were 1.2 million people in there, according to Josephus, and only 87,000 survived. That over 1.1 million Jews died in that siege. Now think about that. At that time, historians tell us that there were about 4 million Jews living in the known world. 25% of the Jewish population died in that city, most of starvation. F.F. Bruce says, as the siege wore on, the horrors of famine and even cannibalism were added to the hazards of war, but the defenders had no thought of capitulating, least of all when Titus, using Josephus as his interpreter, urged the advantages of a timely surrender. And on September 26th, they refused to surrender, and there's a reason why they refused to surrender that's important here, and we'll talk about it in a minute. But they refused to surrender. They got starved out. When you read the history, mothers were eating their babies. People were eating animal dung. When the Romans came in, they were throwing babies up on spears, what was left, and catching them with their spears. The horror of that event was unseen up to that moment. So you have this vast bloodshed, but you also have the destruction of Old Testament Judaism. By the way, I'm getting to something. I told you that I tend to get in the weeds in the prophecy. Because when the temple was destroyed, Old Testament Judaism died. It died. Because as Jacob Neusner, who is probably considered by many to be the greatest Jewish rabbi of our time, he said, while the temple stood, it was a visible center of Jews everywhere, a symbol of God's relationship with Israel, and a means of maintaining the covenant. See, again, and we've said this before, you can't have Old Testament Judaism without the sacrifices, without the daily sacrifices, without the Holy of Holies. You can't have Old Testament Judaism without the priesthood. I mean, think about all of the laws that Moses gave to govern the life of Israel. Think about how many of those laws were based upon there being a tabernacle or a temple. And in fact, Once the temple was gone and the Jews saw that rebuilding it was hopeless, they began to rewrite Judaism. They began to rewrite it. And what is Judaism today bears some resemblance to Old Testament Judaism, but the Jews of today cannot honestly say that they practice Old Testament Judaism. They don't have daily sacrifices. They're not offering lambs up. There isn't a priesthood. There isn't a holy of holies. There isn't a high priest going in once a year for the forgiveness of sins. So Old Testament Judaism died when the temple was taken down. Now, so here they are in this temple. And again, after Jesus makes these comments that it's coming down, his disciples say to him, they ask in verse 3, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming? And your King James would say the end of the world. Other translations say end of the age. So when is this going to happen, Jesus? Now they're looking at the temple. The first question is, when is that going to happen? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the world or the end of the age? Now the question is that three questions? In other words, are they saying, we are astounded at what you have just said 5 minutes ago? When will the temple be destroyed? And oh, by the way, when will your second coming be? And what will be the signs of the end of the world? Or are they asking the same question three different ways? Are they asking three questions? Or are they flabbergasted and they say, when is this gonna happen? When's God bringing judgment on the Jewish people? When's the Jewish age ending? Are they shocked and really just asking one question in three different ways because of the enormity of what Jesus has just said? And the greatest evidence that they are asking the same question in three different ways comes from the parallel passages. Because look how Mark chapter 13, and Mark, by the way, records the words of Peter. But look how Peter, have you got that, Andrew, Mark chapter 13? Now notice the similarities. Then as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now that's very, very, almost word for word what Matthew says. "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately," and Peter's there firsthand, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?" And Jesus answered identically in Matthew 24, "Take heed that no one deceives you." So here's Peter saying, what we ask was, when will that happen, and what will be the signs that it's about to happen? Now look how Luke chapter 21 says it. "Then as some spoke," this is the other parallel passage, "of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, 'These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down.'" Same thing, Matthew 24, parallel passage. "So they ask him, saying, 'Teacher, when will these things be, and what shall be there? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place?' And he said, 'Take heed that no one deceives you.'" So Matthew says that the disciples ask, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the world? But Peter says, this is what I heard, and this is literally what Jesus said. He said, when will these things be, and what will be the sign that these things are being fulfilled? And Luke says, yes, it was, Master, but when will these things be, and what will the signs be when these things shall come to pass? So again, Mark, Luke shed light on Matthew, and what they're saying is, it's really one question. What the disciples were asking was, when will this be, and what will be the sign that God is bringing vengeance on Jerusalem, and what will be the signs then of the end of the age, the Jewish age? And that's the preface of what they're talking about in Matthew chapter 24. When's this going to happen? What are going to be the signs of God's judgment on the people of Israel of that day? Because again, when Jesus says the temple's coming down, it's being destroyed, Jerusalem's going down, that can't happen unless God is bringing that about. If God stood up and defended his people, nobody could have taken the temple. So God, the preface, the understanding here is, if the temple's coming down, God's abandoned the Jewish people. He's not going to defend you. He's going to allow for the whole place to come down, and that is strongly evidence that he's fighting against the Jewish people, not for them, but against them. So what's going to be the sign of his coming? And by the way, most of the time in the Bible, when it talks about the coming of the Lord, it's not talking about the second coming. Very, very rarely is it talking about the second coming. Almost always, it's talking about the Lord coming in judgment. In fact, look at these passages very quickly in Revelation chapter 2. This is Jesus talking here, and look how he talks. He said, remember, he's talking to these churches, remember therefore from where you have fallen, repent and do the first works, or else I will come. Now that's not a second coming. That's not him putting his feet on the earth. He's saying, I'll come and I'll fight against you, and I'll remove your lampstand, or I'll remove my spirit from your midst. And he says that to any church today that has lost their first love. He says, I'll come and I'll fight against you, and I'll remove my spirit from you. Look at how he uses it in 2:11. Or 2:16. Repent or else I will come to you quickly and fight against them with the sword of my mouth. That's not a second coming. That's him coming in judgment on those people. Look at the other one, 3:3. Remember, therefore, how you have received and heard. Hold fast and repent. Therefore, if you will not watch, I will come upon you as a thief. In other words, I'm going to come, and you're not going to be expecting, but I'm going to send judgment on you for your disobedience. The vast majority of time, particularly in the Old Testament, when it talks about Jesus coming, it's not the second coming. It's talking about him sending judgment on people for their disobedience. And so again, when the disciples say, okay, what's going to be the sign of your coming? Don't immediately jump to second coming unless the text tells you to jump to the second coming. And there's nothing here that says you ought to jump to the second coming. Jerusalem is being judged. There's no way that the temple can go down unless they are under divine judgment. So when is he coming? When is he sending judgment? And then they say, and what will be the sign of the end of the world or the end of the age? And again, in the Greek language, there are three words that are translated word. There's cosmos, which very definitely means the world. We use it for the cosmic. That's where the word comes from. There's oikoumene, which means the inhabited world, not the planets, but the inhabited world. And there's aeon, which means age. And the word here is not cosmos, it's age. What will be the sign of the end of the age? So again, they're asking, I know I'm being tedious here, but I'm trying to lay a foundation. They're asking him, when's the temple coming down? What's going to be the sign of God's judgment upon this generation? And that goes back to Matthew chapter 23 when he says, all the blood of the prophets, all the blood that's been shed of all the ages will fall on this generation. So he's saying, what's going to be the sign that this judgment is coming? Because he's just said that a few verses earlier. That's in their mind. And what will be the sign of the end of the Old Testament age, the Jewish age? And by the way, in the New Testament, they believed that, again, not that, I don't think the New Testament writers, some people say they thought that Christ was going to come again really soon. I don't think so. I think when they talk about the end of the age, they're talking about living in the end of the Jewish age. They're writing in the 60s. Look at 1 Corinthians 7:31. Sorry, I'm not going to finish in time tonight, but I'll stop it. I'll stop at 8. Paul says, for the form of this world, that's not what I have. Yeah, for the form of this world is passing away. The form of this age, the structure of this age is passing away. And what's he talking about? He's talking about the Jewish age, Judaism. This thing is passing away there. It's about to be destroyed. There's a new age born. That's why in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, I believe, that's where he's telling singles, it's not a sin if you get married, but if I were you, I wouldn't get married because of the times we live in. And if you think about it, that makes perfect sense. If there's going to be a massive invasion, if 25% of the Jewish people are going to be killed, this is not a great time to be starting a family and having kids. So he says, it'd be better, given what's going on, it'd be better that you all not get married because it's going to get really dicey. 1 Corinthians 10 says, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the end of the ages have come. And they're not looking at the future. It's looking at the end of the Jewish age, the beginning, really, of the Christian age, although they wouldn't have said it quite like that. Hebrews 9:26. Andrew, you got 9:26, or did I forget to? Okay, let me read it to you. It says, he then would have had to offer often since the foundation of the world, talking about sacrifices, and now once, at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Now get that. Hebrews 9:26 says, here at the end of the age, what age? The Jewish age. At the end of the age, Jesus Christ has appeared to put away sin by sacrificing himself. You know what he's saying? Jesus Christ is the final sacrifice. After Jesus Christ, there are not going to be any more sacrifices in the temple. He has appeared at the end of the sacrificial temple age, once and for all, to offer a sacrifice for sins. That Old Testament age, it's past, it's done away with. God's not going to forgive sin based on any animal sacrifices. Once at the end of the age, Jesus Christ has appeared to put away sin once and for all. Now again, that's what Matthew chapter 24 is getting. That's what they're asking. When's the end of the age? When is all this coming down? And Jesus is telling them. Now, in verse 5, and I'll run 13 minutes and we'll stop wherever the cards are dealt. Not that I meant to use a gambling term, Josh. Now Jesus says, now here are some of the signs. Verse 5. He says, for many will come in my name saying, I am Christ, and will deceive many. Now, did that happen in the time leading up to the destruction of the temple and the end of the Jewish age? Well, yeah. Matthew chapter 5, verse 34 through 37, talks about how a guy named Thaddeus raised up, convincing people he was somebody, and led many people astray. Verse 36, that's Acts chapter 5, 36. Verse 37, there's a man named Judas of Galilee rose up and drew many people away after him, he said. Acts chapter 8, Simon Magnus, who wanted to buy the Holy Spirit. They, in fact, discovered near the Tiber River where he lived, when they were doing archaeological digs, something that said, a statue that said Simoni Deo Sancta, which means Simon, the Holy God. So they worshipped him as the God. In Acts chapter 21, Paul is asked, are you the Egyptian that led, stirred up a rebellion and led many people out into the wilderness? So in Acts, there are false prophets that are mentioned who are leading people astray. And Josephus, who was in Jerusalem when it fell, and gives an eyewitness account, it's very important what he says. He says, and I quote, he said, a false prophet was the occasion of the people's destruction, who had made a public proclamation in the city that very day, the day the city fell. Here's a false prophet. He says that God commanded them to get up upon the temple and that they would receive miraculous signs of their deliverance. Now, there was a great number of false prophets suborned by the tyrants to impose upon the people who denounced this to them that they should wait for the deliverance of God. Now, what's he saying? He's saying that the Romans, when they surrounded the city, paid people to go into the city and act like a false prophet and saying, we need to stay right here. We don't need to fight the Romans, because God will deliver us. Let's not fight the Romans. God will deliver us. And what he's saying here, Josephus said that one of the false prophets in Jerusalem, there were many operating, said that he had a vision from God that they should all get on top of the temple. And there on top of the temple, God would deliver them from the top of the temple. And that was the day the Romans broke through and burned the temple, and all those people died. So Josephus, who was there, said there were many, many false prophets hired by the Romans operating among the Jewish people at this time. And Jesus says many false prophets will rise up during this time. Verse 6, and you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things so much come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. And there were many Jewish rebellions between the time Jesus gives this prophecy to the destruction in 70 AD. But in 66 AD, about a year and a half before the city gets surrounded, 50,000 Jews were killed in Alexandria. They tried to rebel. You had the fortress of Masada, which is famous in history, where many went out into the desert and where it was in the fortress of Masada and stayed many years. In Damascus, 10,000 Jews were killed in a rebellion. The Jews attacked a Roman garrison. This is all in 66, the year before this happens, and they lost 18,000 men. And then when the Roman armies came through, Tacitus, who is the Roman historian, says it was full of calamities, horrible with battles, rent with seditions, savage in peace itself. So this is all 2-3 years before all this goes down. 50,000 killed over here, 10,000, 18,000. Romans are coming in. There's fighting all over the place. And why is it that rumors of wars are so important for prophecy in this time? Because of Pax Roma, Pax Romana, pardon me, the peace of Rome. If you study the history of this time, Rome conquered and they brought peace. The peace of Rome, that was their empire. Rome was so strong, they kept everything under control. They were massive. There wasn't any rebellions that they didn't put down quickly. But in the 4 or 5 years leading up to this, you got rebellions going up all over the place in Judaism. You have wars and rumors of wars. You have earthquakes. There are 5 or 6 major earthquakes in the 15 or 20 years leading up to this. And in fact, Pompeii. Remember Pompeii, how the volcano took out Pompeii, the great city, and they've done so many archaeological digs at Pompeii. That was in 63, 7 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. There were great famines, and I won't read to you page after page of all the famines, but there were tremendous famines during this time leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. So, tons of wars and rumors of wars. And by the way, I want to say this. and I've said it before, this is the most peaceful the world has ever been. How many wars do you know that are going on right now? Besides what might happen between us and Iran. How many global conflicts do you know of right now? Somebody said there's one, maybe two. Maybe if you count the fighting in Afghanistan. This is not a Christian point of view. This is a scientific point of view. This is people who see it. There's only one or two wars going on at best. I think there's a civil war going on in Africa right now. If you say that the signs of the times are wars and rumors of wars, and man, we're seeing that today, that's not a factual thing. That is not factual. That there is not a, since the end of the Cold War, there has not been a multiplication of wars and rumors of wars. It's been relatively peaceful compared to hundreds of years back. Verse 9. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. Now what are they talking about? You say, well, this is the persecution of Christians. Now, you got to go back to the parallels. Look at how Luke 21. Look how Luke says that ought to read. My fingers just aren't magical anymore. I used to be able to. You look at Matthew where this verse is, and Luke it reads like this. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You shall be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Now look how Peter records it to Mark chapter 13. Verse 9. But watch out for yourselves. Again, look, when you go and compare these, this is right where Matthew has this statement in his chronological order here. But watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils, and you will be beaten in the synagogues. You will be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony to them. So again, this isn't talking about persecution in general. This is Christians being delivered up to the synagogues, kings, rulers, councils, presumably Jewish councils. Now, if you know Acts, you know that happened. They were constantly being drug up before the councils and the synagogues and the kings. That is a record of what the Christians were going through in the book of Acts. And then verse 11 through 14. And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that endures unto the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached to all of the world for a witness unto all nations, and then the end will come. Now you say, now, that can't be 65 A.D. The gospel had not gone to the world at that point. But listen to what the Bible says. When the Bible talks about the world, it usually means the Roman Empire. Look at Luke chapter 2, verse 1. And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. Now, he's not talking about the Chinese and the Africans and if Indians are over here. He's not talking about that. All the world means all the Roman world. Caesar can't tax people that aren't in the Roman Empire. Look at Acts chapter 11, verse 28. Then one of them named Agabus stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world. By the way, that great famine came in 65, 5 years before the destruction, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Now what's he mean, the famine through all the world? It happened in the Roman world when Claudius was Caesar. Acts 24:5. For we have found this man a plague. Talking about Paul. It's a real insult, isn't it? He's a plague. A creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. And a ringleader of the sects of the Nazarenes. How did Paul stir up the Jews throughout the whole world? He's talking about the Roman Empire. That's the world that he's talking about. And the New Testament confirms that in the first century, the gospel did go out to the entire world. Look at Romans chapter 1, verse 8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, and that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. The whole world has heard your faith, Paul says. Look at 10:18. But I say, have you not heard? Yes, indeed, their sound has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the end of the earth. The gospel being preached to the end of the earth. Look at Colossians chapter 1, verse 5 and 6. Because of the hope which is laid up for you in heaven, of which you heard before in the word of the truth of the gospel which has come to you, because as it has also in all the world, it's bringing forth fruit as it is also among you since the day you heard and knew the grace of God. Look at that. The gospel's in all the world. Colossians 1:23. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached, that's past tense, which was preached to every creature under heaven. I don't know if that's the dogs and the cats. I don't know what Paul says, but he says, and Paul died before Jerusalem ever fell. He says, it's already been preached to every creature under heaven. Now, you say, what does that mean? I don't know what it means, maybe. I think this is what it means. I think, for instance, at the day of Pentecost, it says that Jews gathered and they represented every nation in the world. At Pentecost, every nation in the world heard the gospel. And they were converted. And out of Pentecost, those Jews that represented every nation in the world, presumably the Roman world, went out to those individual nations that were dominated by the Roman Empire, and they preached the gospel. So Paul says four times, this gospel has already gone out to all the world. So again, Jesus says, when it goes out to all the world, then the end will come. And again, you say, has it been preached to everybody? Hasn't been preached to everybody. Well, do something with those passages I just read then. Figure out what those passages mean. Because again, Paul says in the early 60s, it's already been preached to every creature under heaven, this gospel which you have received. And you say, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means either, but to take Paul at face value, that he saw it, that he did it. And so verse 14, according to Paul, was fulfilled before the destruction of Jerusalem. We're not waiting for it to be fulfilled after the destruction of Jerusalem. Now we want to take the gospel to everybody who hasn't heard it. But again, that's not what Jesus is prophesying. What he prophesied began on the day of Pentecost when representatives from every nation in the world heard it. They were converted and they took that gospel back to their home places and they spread it. And so, again, I told you that it wasn't exciting. I don't have lots of things to say about Russia and China and Iran and Syria tonight. But this is a foundation for, I think, sound theology, not speculation about what the Bible has to say about prophecy. And Jesus, again, is saying, the temple's coming down. The end of the age is coming. Old Testament Judaism is to be no more. Hebrews says Jesus Christ has appeared once and for all at the end of the age and offered his body as a sacrifice. That age is past. And that's what I believe. When you look at these verses, Jesus is driving at. The disciples are asking, when is this going to happen? And he's telling them, what is going to precipitate the destruction of the Jewish age, which is the bringing down of the temple once and for all. All right, well, we'll continue, and next week we'll get into the abomination of desolation. How many of you are excited to hear about the abomination? Don't tell me there's going to be less people here next week. Attendances always shrink, but God bless you. I forgive you. You won't go to hell if you don't make it next week, but I'll be praying that you feel guilty when you sit there watching that ball game. You're saying, I'm watching a football game, and I could be hearing about the abomination of desolation. All right, let's stand.